This is our special Best of Greatest Hits Ripper 76 Soundtrack Album All Killer No Filler Anthology Box Set Collector's Edition 50th Golden Anniversary Episode of the Known Pleasures Podcast. Today, we're going to look back at the last 7 years of Known Pleasures. The highs, the lows, and everything in between. The agony and the XTC. The tears and the fears. The atoms and the answers. The models and the magazines. So sit back, relax, take it easy, and reminisce with us as we look back on the first 7 years of the Known Pleasures Podcast. I came up with my very own mullet theory. Very few scientific publications have cited this theory or given it any credence through controlled experiments. They haven't even interviewed a hairdresser from the 80s. Anyway, here it is.
That's where the mullet started growing, Graham. And your theory the longer the mullet, the worse the music is.
So. Did we get to your mullet theory?
I just think that the mullet theory...
What is your mullet theory, Graham?
Well, I think there's an inverse correlation between the length of someone's mullet and the quality of their music. So Ivor Davies had a very short haircut and did some wonderful music. And as his hair grew longer, the music wasn't quite as great. And I point to Simple Minds and maybe even you too.
Definitely you too.
Right.
What about Def Leppard? Where do they sit in there? Some of their best work was with the mullet.
And the elephant in the room, the elephant in the room is Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yeah, well,
yeah. You can't have any discussion about post-punk without bringing up Billy Ray Cyrus.
Well, I was going to try. But if you're talking about someone at their creative peak, you're talking Achy Breaky Heart, and I don't know whether his mullet got longer in subsequent years.
I thought Miley would have been his creative peak.
Possibly.
His best production.
Linguists have been at loggerheads for centuries about one particular turn of phrase. Arguably getting sidetracked from what we were supposed to be talking about, Mark, Graham and I added our voices to the debate.
It's cocking a snook.
A snoot or a snook?
A snook.
A snook.
Are you sure it's not snoot? What's a snook?
Can we look this up?
No one knows what a snook is, but we know that...
I don't even know what a snoot is.
I know all about cocking a snoot. I've been doing it forever.
I can assure you that you're cocking a snook at post-punk.
Patrick's making this up as he goes along.
By calling a song Life Begins at the Hop.
It can be either. You can use either.
No.
You can.
It is.
I'm not cocking anything other than a snook at anything.
Is this some sort of Dr. Zeus reference?
I think we've mentioned before that the synth pop movement was kind of cocking a snoot at the musical movements before. So it kind of.
Yep.
Sorry to bring back that. I don't know whether it's snoot or snook.
The great cocking a snook versus cocking a snoot debate.
We never did find out which was correct.
So they were turning their nose up.
When the Human League split acrimoniously in 1980, Phil Oakey was left with a dilemma: how to restart the band. So what did he do? He headed to the nightclub.
So yeah. What does Phil do?
So he thinks maybe a female backing vocalist would help.
That'll distract them.
That's always worked before. While I make good my escape off stage.
That's right. I'll hide under this fringe.
So Phil heads out one night in Sheffield.
To a futurist music night.
Yeah.
At a nightclub.
What was it called? The Dolly Daisy nightclub or something?
Something
it was
like
some ridiculous name, which escapes me now, but it was something along those lines with his then girlfriend looking for a backing singer.
It was the Crazy Daisy.
Crazy Daisy. I don't know about the Dolly Daisy. Yeah. And he sees a couple of girls dancing in the club and goes, well, they could be, you know, or one of them or both of them could be what we're looking for. And apparently they had a great look and had great moves and sort of just looked like what he imagined wanted, which is just amazing in itself.
Yeah.
So he approaches them. He's well known around the scene, so they know this guy.
Yeah.
And sort of recruits them to join the Human League Part 2. They hadn't finished high school.
Yes,
they were
that's
still
right.
currently studying for their is it GCSEs in England or was it
is it GCSE?
Something like that. Maybe it was something
O-levels
different.
Or A-levels.
A-levels probably was. They're probably in year 11, the equivalent here. Or 12. So he approaches them, gives them the spiel. They go, that's great. That's the great story to come out of the split, because Phil Oakey was against all odds, got up off the canvas, went to the local nightclub, got himself a couple of schoolgirls, knocked it out of the park. And that's a feel-good story everyone can get behind.
Especially in 2018. Yeah.
The Talking Head story couldn't be complete without the sad story of the Overton Bridge.
Yeah, so David Byrne was born in Scotland, in Dumbarton, which is near Glasgow. And Dumbarton is regularly voted one of the most depressing places in the UK. But from my point of view, the most extraordinary thing about the place is a particular bridge, the Overton Bridge, and a remarkable and tragic number of dogs have jumped to their death from a very particular point on this bridge. 50 in the last 50 years. Have
That's tragic.
to their doom, and over 600 have jumped and have survived.
Yeah, well, that's so positive.
Yeah, yeah. This, it's
some good news in this story.
Yeah, it's a good news story. Don't get me wrong.
I feel great already.
But so it's just this extraordinary kind of idea of a particular spot on a particular bridge in Dumbarton, and I quite like the idea of a parallel universe in which a David Byrne who stayed in Dumbarton developed a Proclaimers-esque Scottish accent and wrote a song about this particular spot on this particular bridge, which seems like quite a David Byrne thing to do.
I somehow think if that had happened, we wouldn't be talking about him today. But the dog suicide bridge is great stuff. It's a rare thing.
Yeah.
I know you don't hear about dog depression all that much.
No. It's swept under the carpet, Graham. It doesn't get enough publicity.
No. So, but I have seen footage of the bridge, and you can't tell from a dog's perspective. I've done some research that you will be jumping to your doom.
Right.
Because it's
so
a 4 foot
high. Maybe they're
high.
Seeing somebody waving a bone.
Mm. There is talk of a particular aroma, a scent.
Okay.
Was one theory that had been raised.
And where's David Byrne fitting into this again?
Well, I'm more interested in the dog bridge myself.
Well, yeah, well, so you're saying the dogs didn't know they were jumping to their death?
That's my suspicion, yes. Given the average height of a dog.
Well, you're closer to that than Graham or I. So
well,
from a dog's perspective.
As the most diminutive member of the trio, I feel comfortable in asserting what a dog can't see.
When Mark heard the dulcet tones of David Byrne over the PA at his local supermarket, the world seemed like a wonderful place. But
in terms of its importance out there, I have to tell you a story about one of the tracks that I was in the supermarket recently. In Coles in Edgecliff.
In Edgecliff,
which is a suburb here in Sydney.
Yes.
And I was doing my shopping, popping things into the trolley as you do, humming away. And I started to hear Cross-Eyed and Painless over the stereo.
Was that unusual?
Hear music in the supermarket, and I was like, wow, you know, this is fantastic.
They didn't play a lot of post-punk?
Not a lot of post-punk.
Coles in Edgecliff?
Maybe not as much as you'd expect. But I could hear it playing there, and I was thinking, this is sensational. It's really seeped into the consciousness of places. Here we are in 2018.
And it wasn't a huge hit.
Wasn't a huge hit, but nevertheless, there it was. And I was feeling really good about that. Well, that was that. Now, the world's not such a horrible, cold, barren place. You can hear Cross-Eyed and Painless.
You weren't in a great mood doing the shopping.
No, I was doing the shopping. And I'm pushing my trolley away, pay for my purchases, as you do, leave the shopping area there out into the centre, and I can still hear it. So it's actually the Edgecliff Centre's playing.
So it's not just Coles.
Not just
it's
Coles.
Not just some random dude at
this
Coles.
This day is getting
gone feral.
Better and better. This is a great day. And so I'm happily thinking about this as I'm leaving the centre. And as I leave the centre, I can still hear it.
So it's actually Sydney.
It's the world.
Sydney is playing Cross-Eyed and Painless.
So I'm starting to walk down to the car park and I can still hear it. And I'm just, this is fantastic. And at this point, I realise that it's coming out of my bag. And it's actually my phone. Somehow or another, I've knocked the button on it and it's playing just quietly enough that I can hear it.
Wow,
that
right.
it's my own personal soundtrack.
Wow. So the world
really was
as cold and barren a place as you'd originally
feared. And then I went and looked for the dog bridge.
Mid Yor, singer of Vienna, co-creator of Visage, co-writer of Do They Know It's Christmas and the Top of the Pops theme song, What's Not to Love? Let's ask Mark.
fair play to Midgeur. He's an opportunist. I've said that before. We Midgeur. He knows when something's coming, and he was between gigs.
Adam Ant is the most opportunistic pop star this side of Midgeur, because he saw an opportunity and he ran
this
with it.
Side of Midgeur. How did Midgeur become the benchmark for cynical opportunism?
Ask Midge. Ask Midge. That's all right.
Well, I just like it on record that I do not endorse Mark's view of Midgeur. That's all.
I think he's fine too.
That sounds like something Midge would say.
Midge, you were the perfect gentleman.
He's there. He's always there. He's always got his ear at the door.
He's a good man.
He's a good man.
I love Midge and I love Ultravox, and you just watch yourself.
The passing of the Big Bopper in the 1950s will long be remembered as the day the music died. I wanted Graham and Mark to know all about it.
Part of me always comes back to the Big Bopper equation, the plane that crashed, killing the Big Bopper.
Yeah, never a day goes by without Patrick mentioning this. It's scarred you, hasn't it?
And several other musical legends.
I love the fact plane that crashed. Out of all those people, it's the Big Bopper. Well, your morning.
He's the one who was always closest to my heart. But according to what I call the Big Bopper factor, I do think sometimes in terms of...
Are we talking about the same thing?
Hello and welcome to my 50s rock and roll program, where we pay tribute to Richie Valens and La Bamba.
Are you saying that the Big Bopper would have sold out eventually?
That's what I'm saying. For the Big Bopper.
Surely not.
First thought of bopping.
So 1957, this we're talking sort of Big Bopper time.
It is, yeah. Look, had the Big Bopper perished by 1957? That's the question.
Buddy Holly gets a mention, but not the Big Bopper.
Shame. In some ways, I mean, we've talked about the Big Bopper effect where, you know, jokingly, that certain bands who've lived on for several decades might have been better off if they'd perished in a light plane crash somewhere in the United States. And the birthday party were never likely to outstay their welcome. Nick Cave's musical and lyrical exploration was never likely to kind of end in that way.
When talk turns to brothels, as it often does at Known Pleasures, one super producer's name crops up. But this story has a happy ending.
And in 2015, he was convicted of keeping a brothel.
Really?
Really?
which is...
Hang on, what's keeping a brothel? Is that actually owning it or just frequenting the brothel?
Well, it's not letting other people share in your brothel.
Yeah. It was.
You're not taking on customers. You're just basically, it's an exclusive thing, which is really, really selfish and illegal.
It was the hoarding of the brothel that was the problem.
If you're going to own a brothel, let others come and share it. That's always been my philosophy.
Well, that's a good business model, I think.
So, yeah.
All proof.
So that was David Lord. I'm glad you mentioned him.
As a young man at a psychedelic furs concert, I made a crucial mistake in semantics. It's plagued me ever since. Basically, my favourite song on the first album was a song called Imitation of Christ. And I saw the Psychedelic Furs at Festival Hall in Brisbane. I was right up against the front of the stage and I was chanting for them to play this song.
You were chanting?
Yes, I was.
Imitation.
I don't often chant.
No.
But in this case, I did. Actually, I was calling out for them to play the song.
What was the rhythm of how you were doing it? Was it
that's what I wanted.
Imitation. Maybe I shouldn't have used the word chant. I was calling out for them to play the song, but it wasn't until later I realised I was shouting out impersonation of Christ.
Over here, impersonation of Christ.
Which,
could you not?
I've laughed about this for many years later because I thought I was asking Richard Butler to do an impression. Do Christopher Walken.
Did he respond to you at all or acknowledge you?
No. I don't think anyone heard me. No. To tell the truth.
A gap formed around you.
Yes. Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. It'd be like, do an impression.
Michael Caine.
Do an impression of Christ.
Comedy comes down the road, mate.
Richard Butler goes up to the microphone and goes, has anyone ever wondered what it would be if Christ went into the DMV? I think it would sound something like this.
While this band had nothing to do with post-punk, apart from featuring future Blondie producer Richard Gotterer, the story of a young American group, The Strangeloves, had a strangeness we loved.
Did you see the backstory to The Strangeloves? They were around at the time of the British invasion, 64-65, and they kind of wanted to get onto that bandwagon. You know, they were an American band, but they didn't think they could pull off the English accent, so they decided to pretend to be Australian.
And it's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, as they said, no one knew. No one had ever met an Australian in the US, so they thought they could probably get away with
that. So Rolf Harris wasn't a superstar in the US. You're telling me this. Now I hear this.
I believe not.
Wow.
I believe not.
Okay.
But, yeah, so their media releases went out with them. They were allegedly three brothers named Giles, Miles and Niles. Strange. And they were sheep farmers. I'm not making this up. They were sheep farmers who'd made their fortune by developing a new form of sheep crossbreeding.
That's a complicated backstory.
This was supposed to be like a backdrop to like sexy young pop stars. It was. Yeah, I'm not sure how long they maintained that facade. But yeah, the song I Want Candy was allegedly written by three sheep farmers from Australia.
In the same Blondie episode, the subject of the dangers of stone fruit came up and we couldn't shut up about it. And then at some point, Clem Burke came out onto stage and said that Blondie won't be able to play because Debbie Harry was sick.
Mm.
And the reason that they gave was that she overdosed on cherries.
Mm. The cherry might have been slang for something else.
Well, now, I know you guys are aware that in rock and roll, we've lost a lot of great people to stone fruits over the years.
Mm. It's the number one killer of rock stars.
We lost Jim Morrison to nectarines, for instance. You know, it's been
Peaches
constant.
Did Sid Vicious.
That's right. So the story was that, and this came from the tour manager, I think, New York had fruit, apparently. But in Australia, we really had the good stuff. So,
once again, is this? We're not talking about fruit here, are we? Really?
Well, this is it. It was all pure.
You've got to go to Australia for the good stuff. It's pure, uncut fruit.
Uncut, no stems.
No stems. Skin on. It'll knock your socks off.
Pure maraschino. But. So everyone must have bought that excuse, but I just think that's hilarious.
Yeah, I don't buy that.
How did cherry sales go during the subsequent
You couldn't
weeks?
Get cherries. I mean, they were expensive. No.
There was a riot, as you say, at the...
A stage door was pulled off its hinges.
Hmm.
Cherries will drive you crazy. They give you super strength.
The entire audience on cherries?
I think so.
Possibly.
I think a lot of fruit stands in the area were closed. Subsequently closed down because of it.
Okay, well, we haven't milked this one dry at all. How does one person do that?
I mean, that person that was born in Nambour in Queensland.
Yeah, I know. Where is Nambour
it's
in
like
Queensland?
North Queensland. It's a fruit town, as far as I'm aware. So that could be
the
connection.
That's the missing
link. Fruit area.
Well, Nambour is like the Columbia of North Queensland.
Yeah, you go to Nambour for the good stuff.
For some reason, Mark and Patrick took a great deal of interest in what I did for a living during the post-punk era, mainly because they were still in high school. And I was contributing to society. I do want to point out that in 1980, when it came out, I was a swimming pool attendant in Brisbane.
What did that involve? You went to the pool? Well, we would like to work these things along the lines of what you were doing for a living when these things happened. So we know when the police toured, you're a pool attendant.
Yeah, let's forget the pleasure principle. I want to hear what Graham was doing for a living a year later.
What were you doing when Replicas came out?
When Replicas came out, I was a... I was working at a place called Tilling Timber. I worked at a timber yard.
Where were you working at this point?
Were you working in a lumber yard at the time?
We talked about that for some time. 1984, where were you?
84. I was in liquor stores by then.
Moved up.
Yeah.
The lumber yard.
Hmm. I was selling alcohol to underage kids.
You're calling. Does it slot into your pool job days at all? Was it part of the soundtrack?
No, it wasn't. This was 79. This was the timber yard. Years.
The lumber years.
As a swimming pool guard, was that what?
Lifeguard.
Lifeguard.
No, I wasn't lifeguard. I was a swimming pool attendant. I used to dose the pools up with drugs.
Check their chlorine levels, pick up coins off the bottom, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Were you a big vinyl buyer? Okay, because you had a job working in the lumberyard.
Well, yeah, there was lumberyard, but by the time Panorama came along, I was entrenched in pools.
You were knee-deep in pools?
I was knee-deep in pools at this point, yeah. Around this time in May 79, when I started working in the timber yards,
This period, timber yard.
the lumber years.
Yeah. Well, the lumber yard's not for the faint-hearted. It's not an easy place to work.
They wanted to go out with me, but, you know, not with someone who works in lumber. You know, it's like working with a policeman, you know. You just never know when he's going to come back home.
You were cleaning the swimming pool that you were attending to?
No.
Lumberyard?
No, I was selling liquor at that point.
slinging rocks on the corner. This was the drug dealing phase.
I had a still.
We talk about your years as a swimming pool attendant, working in a lumber yard.
Yeah.
You've been everywhere, man.
I have been everywhere. But look at me now.
Mm.
Yes.
I get to press record for a living. During 1980, when I was a swimming pool attendant.
Love this period. This is my favourite post-punk era.
Yeah.
Well, the swimming pool era.
Yeah.
There were two albums I had in the car. There was The Police's Zenyatta Bondata, and there was this album, Setting Suns. When I went back and listened to it now, it brought back floods of memories.
Chlorine.
The smell of chlorine.
Did you wear one of those little caps, those things you tie under your chin?
That was more lifesavers, I think. Oh. I wasn't saving anyone's life at this point.
Really? You're trying to tell me swimming pool attendant isn't life-saving work?
Well, just think for a moment about the amount of stress that I was under as a swimming pool attendant at the time. You know, there's
what time did the pool open? Like midday?
Actually, no, it was really early.
So you had to get up early.
I had to get up very early.
Yeah.
But yeah, this album kind of got me through.
Got me
through this difficult time.
Yeah.
I think Thatcher was closing all the swimming pools at the time.
In Australia.
In Australia.
Yeah. And their reach, it was incredible.
we were just marching and.
The right to swim movement had started.
While researching the Ian Jury episode, I was surprised how many people have used his music in advertising. Sex and Drugs and Spray and Wipe.
The one we should all recognise is that Billericay Dicky was repurposed to be a spray and wipe commercial in this country.
I didn't realise that.
For about 25 years, that spray and wipe jingle was played on the television. But I got right up between her,
I'm and her, I've been up. Makes cleaning oh so easy. It's tough on all things greasy. The wedding was a hit, the house looked great, I will admit. So thank you. Ajax Spray and Wipe.
Some advertising executive somewhere, the fact that he heard that song and thought, you know what, Spray and Wipe could use that song.
Winston, of course, is the first name of a notable wartime prime minister, the middle name of John Lennon, and an unsung hero and the electronic heartbeat of orchestral manoeuvres in the dark. And he'll always be a person to me.
Until suddenly it was...
It was just the two of them.
Just the two of them, and they, I think, borrowed a tape recorder, a reel-to-reel tape recorder from a friend of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the three of them started thinking in terms of...
The three of them, one of them being the tape recorder.
The three of them.
Not a real person.
I think that's called anthropomorphism. Yes, so the tape recorder, they named it Winston, and as soon as it had a name, I was thinking of it as being a human being, so...
Yeah, but it wouldn't have been paid, though.
Mm.
The wages would have still been split between the two.
And it wouldn't have helped lug out afterwards.
No, that's right.
So really.
Really, it was just the two of them.
Just the tape recorder and the two people.
Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark had a record deal after 8 months, I think.
Well, I guess it happens. It does happen.
It obviously happened.
They started fully formed, just the three members of OM&D.
Are we going to do an OMD podcast? Oh, that's right. We've already done one.
Just Paul, Andy and Winston. Admittedly,
yeah.
Winston was a tape recorder, but I'm pretty wedded to the idea of them being a trio.
Think woodwind instruments are for namby-pamby, makeup-wearing girly boys? Well, think again.
I read something that he was a bassoon player at school. And
until a gang of skinheads stole it.
Those gang of skinheads again.
Well, I mean,
won't they do?
Well, they were pretty keen on bassoons in those days.
Yeah.
But skinheads.
Well, no, it was a mark of honour to steal someone's bassoon. I remember hearing that. The toughest skinhead would go up to the local classical music recital and steal a bassoon.
A bassoon, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I think the Van Buren boys might have been involved in that.
And it wasn't just any woodwind instrument. It had to be a bassoon.
It had to be a bassoon.
Well, if you wanted to be the leader of the pack,
if I can use that phrase.
In Catford, anyway.
In Catford, you had to steal a bassoon.
Yeah. So the Bromley skinheads, they're
the worst.
They thought that flutes were fine.
Yeah. Different territories, different classical instruments.
Bob mentioned was the fact that Ivo used to play a bit of oboe.
Really?
During
he broke out the oboe.
Yeah, which is, it's hard to picture that in the midst of the punk and glam covers. I'm trying to picture where an oboe solo fits.
It's pretty punk rock.
Onto God Save the Queen.
So maybe it was one of those rebellious instruments of the late 70s that we just don't know about.
Da-do-do-do, da-da-da-da, that's fine by me. But Paddy and Graham are sticklers for lyrics making sense.
I do have a question about these lyrics, though, for you guys. In the song, he says, I've a little money and a takeaway curry. I'm on my way home to my wife. She'll be lining up the cutlery. You know she's expecting me, polishing the glasses and pulling out the cork. If he's bringing dinner home for his wife, why is it midnight?
And also, he's already got a bottle of wine and she's opening one.
Mm.
So what's going on there?
No, that's right.
I reckon he got the curry early on in the night and he snuck away for a couple of cheeky beers.
Mm.
And all of a sudden it's midnight.
And he's forgotten.
He's forgotten. I reckon his wife is going to be furious when
it's
he gets
It's going to be
home.
A pretty cold curry.
Yeah. Mm. I think
well, he says, you know, she's waiting for me. You know, so, yeah.
Yeah, she certainly is.
She's rolling.
But I'm not sure how many places you could get a takeaway curry at 11:45.
This is London. What would the shift working situation like?
Well, this is it.
People doing late shifts.
If he's a shift worker, then fine, I understand that. But his wife's not going to be waiting for him to get home to have dinner.
Maybe they've just gotten married, Graham, and things are fresh. Do you remember what that was like? You know, when your wife wanted to see you? Wait up for you?
I think we're talking a little bit about us at this point.
let's give Paul the benefit of some poetic license. Planets and lava.
There's an implication of a relationship with the woman from Planet Claire.
Possibly.
I think.
Yeah.
Possibly.
But I do have a couple of questions about
about actual Claire.
Well, if she didn't have a head.
Well, no one had a head there.
How was she driving a Plymouth satellite?
I think at the DMV, having a head is like a prerequisite.
The authorities in Athens, Georgia, did they not notice?
Well, it was on Planet Claire.
I do have a problem with the lyrics, though.
Okay.
It starts with a guy who sees a girl with eyes that hypnotise. Okay.
Mm. Are you okay with that?
I'm okay with that.
Yep.
That never happens.
No.
But he seems to get scared and tries to run away. But there's a contradiction in the chorus where he says he ran so far away, and then he says, I couldn't get away. Which suggests that he didn't run far away at all. So the song should have been called I Tried to Run. So far away. And then he couldn't get away.
Love's a funny thing though, Graham.
I know, it is. And also, if he went with my idea, it probably wouldn't have been a hit.
I understand that the man in question in the song sees an aurora in the sky and he and the woman are abducted by aliens.
Yes.
So.
Well, don't tell me that couldn't happen.
Well, if we're believing in hypnotism by eyes, I mean, just how gullible are we?
So in the second stanza, he's now running away from aliens with this girl.
You got a real problem with these lyrics, ain't you?
I just can't follow them.
What are you expecting from a pop song?
Well, I just wanted to make a little bit of sense.
Okay.
One of the fun things I've got to do in putting together these podcasts is being able to add a sound effect, put together a montage, or record a new version of a song purely for shits and giggles. Here's a few of my favourites.
The album, and I was thinking, what's it called? And I said, Secondhand Delight. And you acted.
That's a great song.
you acted as if I'd misquoted the Ten Commandments.
Well, that's pretty much how I feel.
Secondhand Delight. A village far, far away.
On the outskirts of Liverpool.
Yeah, I'll put in some harp music here.
A small town called, I think it's pronounced Mels.
Well, it's just to try and hear Daryl Hall's voice, and I think you can hear it here in the second part of this chorus. Have a listen.
You're wrong, Patrick. It's massive. Everybody loves it.
Hang on. I'm going to have to roll back the tape to me not liking it.
I think you'll find that was me who said he didn't like it. I'll rewind the tape and check it out.
I didn't think the song was that great, to tell the truth.
Yep, that was me.
It's sort of a gateway for people to seek a bigger audience. They played Rock, Lobster and Dance This Mess Around. If you get a chance to see those performances, it's fantastic. Now, a young Kurt Cobain apparently was watching, and he was very much inspired by what he saw on this particular evening, that there was stuff like this happening in America. Great stuff if you get a chance to look at it.
My favourite song on the album is Cake.
You don't feel like it's undercooked.
I don't want to make...
That was the only pun I was going to do in this episode, and I got nothing.
I will put in a smattering of applause.
All crickets.
My favourite song on the album is Cake.
You don't feel like it's undercooked.
Jet Black, ice cream magnate and entrepreneur. Born in 1938, Jet showed a musical proficiency at an early age, playing piano, violin and the beat drums. After a seven-year apprenticeship as a joiner, he went out into the world to make his mark. He gave up any musical aspirations he had to go into the manufacturing and distribution of soft-served ice cream, or as it was known at the time, iced confection. Yes, nice and creamy does it. Does it every time. Success came quickly to Jet Black, with his fleet of iced confection vans zooming around the Guildford area, making all of the kids and housewives as happy as clams. Jet branched out his empire into home brewing. What's that tasty treat you're drinking, little boy? Why, that's Jet's famous home brew. But maybe try it when you're over 14. Jet's empire went from strength to strength, culminating in his purchase of an off-license in Guildford. What will be next in the Jet Black story? Only time will tell.
When Patrick starts an anecdote, he'd best beware the snark of Mark.
Red Frame White Light has been one of my favourites, and I don't know if you know the background to that song.
Well, it's about a phone booth in Liverpool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about neither the Humphreys nor the McCluskey family had a phone. Red This phone booth outside the local pub, the Railway Inn, served as the kind of home phone for maybe several families. And the number was 632-3003, which features in the lyric. So the phone would kind of ring, and there'd be people, you know, like playing football in the park nearby, and they'd kind of answer the phone, and you know, it'd be someone calling from Italy.
Do you know this for a fact?
Yeah.
They were calling from Italy. So there was a real Italian connection with this.
This was after the first album came out. They still had this, you know, as their office.
This was other families were getting
as their office number. This was the, perhaps I haven't told this anecdote as well as I thought I told it. But for a year or so, maybe 18 months, this was the number. This was the official Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark phone number. And according to my sources, you know, there was a park nearby, and the phone would ring, and people would kind of run to the phone, and it, you know, it could be someone calling from anywhere in Europe saying,
like Italy, for example.
Hello, like Italy, saying, "Is Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark there, please?"
In an Italian accent.
No, I'm not gonna.
When chronology isn't my strong point, the whole countdown goes awry.
Graham, I think you're up again next.
Am I Billy Joel?
No, you're Alice Cooper, though, because Patrick decided to change the order.
Yeah, Patrick decided to change the order at the 11th hour, and now the wheels have come off the rails. Okay, I just had to scroll a bit further. Okay, number four is Alice Cooper, and the song
Five is Alice Cooper. Five is Alice Cooper.
Let me try that once again.
He won't change, Patrick.
No.
I'm not changing. I'm really regretting my humble request.
I'm sorry, Patrick, but it's now going to go 6, 4, 5. That's how we're counting this down.
You just can't bring yourself. You can't bring yourself to do it.
I can't backspace and type in a new number. It's beyond my capabilities. Okay, number five is Alice Cooper, and the song is Clones. What was the connection between Come On Eileen and Warner Brothers cartoons? We at Known Pleasures took a deep dive into a long-running and explosive animated joke. Speaking of sections, the very first thing you hear is Helen O'Hara playing an old Irish folk song called Those Endearing Young Charms. Which is a song that's so old, they don't know who wrote the melody, but apparently someone called Thomas Moore wrote the lyric.
He rewrote the lyrics from an earlier sort of British lyric because he wanted to kind of reclaim it for the Irish, if you like, because it was a traditional Irish melody. That's my vague understanding of the story.
Well, when I first heard it, I recognised the melody, and I didn't realise that because I had been brought up listening to it via various Warner Brothers cartoons. I don't know if you know about this, but there was a particular trope or running gag featured in their cartoons where a character, let's say Daffy Duck, would rig up an explosive to a particular note on a piano or xylophone.
When he strikes this note, instead of a xylophone, he'll be playing a harp.
Then their nemesis, we'll call him Bugs Bunny.
Now with your kind indulgence, I'll play Those Endearing Young Charms.
Would play the said instrument and keep getting the last note wrong, which was the explosive note.
Try it again!
And then in a fit of frustration, Daffy, momentarily forgetting he had to set up the explosive, would yell at Bugs.
Oh, no, no, you stupid rabbit! Like this!
Play the melody himself and hit the correct note, thus blowing himself up. And the melody they were playing was this Endearing Young Charm song. Now, this was a running gag that started in 1944, and the last time they did it was an episode of Animaniacs in 1994. So this running gag went from the end of World War II to the start of the Bosnian War. So it's a long time to have a running gag.
Yeah.
So a lot of innocent animated characters lost their lives during this time.
Almost to that melody.
Almost, if it wasn't for that final A note.
Yeah, it would have been great if Helen got the last note wrong as well.
Yeah.
And then there was an explosion.
Kevin Rowland ran in and went, no. And there was an explosion. Then. Mark, Patrick and I have had our favourite words and phrases that don't bear repeating. So here we are repeating them. I had a predilection for saying I like you. I like you guys. I like you guys. I like you, I think.
I like you too.
I, comma, like you. I like many other people. Patrick's Irv was saying Irv.
Either of you are very familiar with the Clark Kent Irv? The Irv.
In her Irv?
Mike Howlett gets mentioned on this podcast more often than Patrick says oeuvre. And Mark was fond of telling us it was a different time.
Different times? It was a different times. Style at the time.
It was of its time.
It was the times. Well, it was different times. It was the style of the time. Different times, as Graham's fond of saying.
One thing I enjoy doing in this podcast is mashing together songs to highlight a similarity or a shared influence. Here are some of my favourites. Leo Sayer.
Leo Sayer.
The bridge was taken straight from that song.
Yes. I don't think many people listening to that song would have gone, you know what, that's more than a whiff of Leo Sayer about that.
Let me show you Exhibit A. I think it was a nice little melody that he utilised very tastefully, and it made the song as far as I can see. But yeah, I think Sting was a bit of a fan. Every breath you take, every move you make, every bond you break, every step you take, I'll be watching you. And that song goes into the Heart, which I really like. It kind of reminds me a bit of the Psychedelic Furs Heartbreak beat.
Inspired to write this after listening to the Clashes album. Basically, he said he sat up all night, drank 50 coffees, and went over the Clashes album.
At this point, there are no court cases pending. Well, that's the end of our first compilation album. Thanks for listening, and here's to another 7 years or 50 episodes, whichever comes first. We'll be right back.